I'm Lisa DeLay, and you're listening to the Spark My Muse podcast. So welcome to Spark My Muse. Today, I have a guest on from England, and it's Kester Bruin. And thank you so much, Kester, for being my guest today.
Pleasure. It's really great to be here. Yeah. From London, all the way from London.
Yay. And it's just such a great pleasure. And I wasn't going to try to introduce you to my audience. I was going to try to have you introduce yourself because I know you're a man of many talents. And I first saw you on a TEDx talk on YouTube. And so I thought maybe you could sort of introduce yourself.
Great. Well, I mean, part of my time I spend teaching mathematics at math. Singular, yeah, I'm talking to Americans, and at what we call, well, you'd call it high school level, so ages 11 to 18, so that's kind of my day job. Mm-hmm. And then many years ago, I started a community called Vox with a friend of mine, which was looking at kind of alternative forms of church and that kind of stuff, and it was through that that I began to write up some of the ideas that we came across as we explored through Vox, which was in London years and years ago. So my first book came out in about 1998 called The Complex Christ. It was called Signs of Emergence in the US. Mm-hmm. Then I wrote another book called Other. And then I wrote this book, Mutiny, which is all about pirates. Mm. And out of that, the guys who organize a big TED event in the UK asked me to come and do a talk, which was absolutely terrifying and brilliant.
Yes, and I'm hoping you can unpack it a little bit, but one of the things that I really appreciated about it was you were talking about pirates kind of coming along when power sort of switches things around, and you're talking about it in terms of nowadays being for music, when music just gets in the hands of the very few and there's just a few gatekeepers, then people come along and democratize it. What made you even kind of come up with talking about pirates in the first place?
Well, and this is genuinely true. as I say in the TED talk, actually, my son, who's now 12 years old, but at the time he was much younger, and he was getting invited to all of these pirate themed birthday parties. Mm-hmm. You know, every other week we had to dress him up as a pirate again. And you know, at one of these events I was like, this is kind of weird, because there's all these kids running around as pirates, but on the news we've got all this stuff about Somali pirates. Mm-hmm. Which was a big thing at the time. And I was like, I said to someone, you know what, the next time he gets invited to a pirate party, I'm sending him along with an AK-47 and a rubber boat, like, or, you know, or with like a plastic bag full of knockoff DVDs or something. Because, like, you know, that's piracy too, right? And I just kind of started thinking more and more about these kind of strange characters. Mm. You know, why is it that we're happy to dress our children as pirates, and yet, you know, then there's all this stuff about them being complete villains and they're going to destroy capitalism and all the rest of it. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, they're celebrated all over the place. I mean, all these Pirates of the Caribbean movies, are they heroes? Are they villains? Mm-hmm. And then, you know, their kind of motif, this skull and crossbones motif, it's like, it's fascinating. As soon as you start looking, you find this skull motif absolutely everywhere. Mm. And you know, in the most surprising of places, like executive ties and and babies feeding bottles. I mean, like, what the hell is happening when you are feeding your baby with, you know, from a bottle with a symbol of death on it? I mean, like, what's going on? So I was like, this needs some investigation. So, you know, yeah, I kind of cranked into the work. But weirdly, like, the more I got into it, the more I realized that this was really fascinating. And it kind of takes a kind of interesting turn in kind of culture and film. And then actually, I think there's a real interesting theological turn in there, too.
Mm. Yeah, well, tell me more about that.
Well, I mean, going back to the golden age of piracy, it's kind of tempting to see these guys as, you know, terrible thieves and villains and all the rest. And sure, you know, we're not talking like the nicest guys in the world. But what you've got to understand from the start is that pirates became pirates as an act of self-determination. Like, their life as sailors before they became pirates was unbelievably bad. I mean, one writer of the day describes being a sailor on one of these Royal Naval ships, you know, being press ganged into sailing. It wasn't like you had any choice. You were press ganged into it. Was like being caught in a machine from which there was no escape, bar incapacitation or death. I mean, it was like a horrible, horrible life. And you were taken away from family and you were treated, you know, like a slave. You were hardly paid. The food was rotten. But what you were doing was generating enormous wealth for these aristocrats back in, you know, the UK and Spain and France and so on. So pirates see, you know, effectively they are serving these aristocrats but getting no access to any of those riches themselves. So their turn to piracy is basically to say, well, we want a bit of that for ourselves. Like, you know, why don't we do this act of self-determination rather than being slaves on a ship? Why don't we take control of that ship? And it's not, you know, what's interesting about pirates isn't the fact they thieved, is because everybody was doing that. You know, that's what the Royal Naval ships were doing too. They were stealing from the French are stealing from the Dutch are stealing from the British, and everyone is stealing from the land, you know. Everyone is ripping the land off. So what the pirates are doing, you know, the reason they're called pirates isn't because they're stealing, it's because they're refusing to pass on what they steal to the king.
Right.
And, you know, what they do is they take this symbol that was used in the ship's log whenever a sailor died, which was kind of, you know, a daily occurrence. The captain of the ship would mark this skull and crossed bones into the ship's log. And they took that symbol and said, we are now dead to you. You know, it's this act of becoming a community of the dead. You know, these people who've taken a radical act of self-determination, and they knew that it would cost them their lives. You know, but the gamble they took was, well, you know, as a sailor, I'm likely to live maybe 2 or 3 years. Well, if it's going to be a short life, it might as well be a merry one. And so, you know, they took control of the ships and off they went. But as you explore how that then links in with piracy to do with pirate radio and kind of internet piracy and all the rest of it, what you realize is that there's a link there, in that what pirates are doing is they will always rise up whenever something that should be held in common has been enclosed into private ownership. And what they do is they break open those wealth stores and set these riches back into circulation. So, you know, the example I use is like back in the 1950s, when pop music first comes around, the BBC in London, you know, they are totally in control of music. There's no other way you can get your music apart from through BBC radio. And they decide they're going to broadcast pop music for 1 hour per week. It's like, whoa, okay. you know, they're making a huge cultural decision there. So what the pirate radio stations do is break that open. They're like, okay, you know, we're going to play pop music, and it's against the law. But what it does is to force the orthodoxy to take a good look at itself and to readjust, and then the BBC break things back open, and so, you know, the music is returned to the people. I mean, that's the kind of general theme of what a pirate does, but it kind of then spins down really interestingly into the kind of film and literature stuff too.
And as far as theology is concerned, how do you see that playing out?
Well, and I guess the way to drill down to that is through one of the turns I take in the book, which is called Mutiny, Why We Love Pirates and How They Can Save Us, is by looking at the story of Peter Pan, which, you know, should be really familiar. You've got this protagonist, Wendy, who, it's her last night in the nursery. So here is someone who's kind of on the cusp of womanhood. And, you know, she's about to become a woman, but at the moment she's still a child. And the play is really about how she negotiates this transition. And she's struggling. She's blocked. You know, her parents have gone out. She's been left in charge of her brothers. She's like, you know, not sure how to move on. And in the anxiety of doing that, you know, this guy, Peter Pan, floats in through the window. And, you know, for anyone who's done any psychotherapy, it's a guy with no shadow. And you're like, oh, okay, interesting. And, you know, he offers her the chance to fly away to a land where she need never grow up. So, you know, let's solve this problem of becoming a woman. You can just never grow up, you know. Mm-hmm. So off she goes, off to Neverland. And when she gets there, it's not quite what it seems like. She actually is taking care of all these lost boys. So she's playing the role of mother, but without actually having grown up. And there's this complete blockage in the story. It's like, what the heck is going on? So again, we get to this place of blockage, and who is going to unblock that? And it happens through the pirates who are introduced in the story.
Yeah.
So what you have is, you know, this place where no one can grow up. And what is reintroduced into the narrative is time through Captain Hook, who is constantly being followed around by this crocodile who's eaten a clock, you know, tick tock, tick tock. Mm. And here comes time back into the narrative. And of course, the only way that Wendy can get back to her parents is if she overcomes the pirates. And then, you know, so the really interesting turn there is that in the original setting of the play, the person who plays the role of Captain Hook is the same guy who plays her father.
Oh.
So the idea that it's in the overcoming of the father that this kind of blockage is removed, and the way forward for her as, you know, this kind of, you know, woman suffering really in terms of the place of women in society at the time, is through overcoming this patriarchy that she can move forward as a person.
Mm.
And you see the exact same thing, interestingly enough, in the Star Wars films. You know, you've got Luke Skywalker, who, you know, there's whole pirate archetypes here. He's with the rebellion, and Darth Vader, his father, is for the Empire. And the only way that he can end up saving his father and moving things on is actually by defeating his father. Now, it suddenly struck me, actually, one day I was chatting to someone, and it suddenly struck me, like, wow, that is purely theological.
Mm.
This idea of of a great store of riches, which is blocked, this idea that, you know, there are those who are in power who have kind of, you know, blocked the way into these sorts of riches and the wealth and everything else. And then you've got these pirates and this idea of overcoming a father. I was like, wow, this is pure theology here.
Mm-hmm.
So what I do in the book is to reread particularly the story of the prodigal son.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, you know, it's a parable. Okay. So it can mm-hmm. be read lots of different ways. That's mm-hmm. why they're such great stories. So I'm kind of fully supportive of the kind of light version of that parable, if you see what I mean, like the mm-hmm. way that it, you know, it's a beautiful parable of redemption and all the rest of it. But I'm kind of interested in opening up to people a slightly darker reading of the parable, which is that it's a tragedy. Now, what happens is this young kid says to his dad, hey, you know, I'm kind of bored of this. I want to get out of here. And basically the dad is all worried that he's going to spend the money on drink and all the rest of it, you know, like, you know, who hasn't worried that with a kid going to university? I mean, you know, it's like, but off the guy goes, and he does live it up, but there's a sense in which the place that he's come from was quite an oppressive place, perhaps. It was a very wealthy place, a place of great privilege.
Mm-hmm.
And when he experiences this great famine, this great need, what he is sure of is that there won't be that back at his father's place. But perhaps he thinks, you know, what I could do is to convince my father to break some of that open, you know, and to share some of those riches and all the rest of it. And, you know, he doesn't want to go back to that place of enclosure. He doesn't want to go back to that place of enclosed riches and oppression. But in the end, you know, he's weak, he's starving, he crawls back, and perhaps he thinks, well, you know, I won't go back as a son, I'll go back as a worker. And yet, you know, when he gets back there, the robe is put on and the ring is put on his finger, and it's almost like, you know what? I was alive and now I'm dead again. And his brother is furious. He was like, man, you were meant to get out of here and have the good time, and look at you, you're back here and there's a huge party. And, it, you know, in literature terms, it's a tragedy, because the story ends where it began, with the father in control.
Hmm.
And I think that's actually not what you see happening in terms of a kind of theological move in the Gospels.
Oh, wow. That's really interesting.
So, yeah. You know, you have Jesus kind of breaking open the commons of heaven, as it were. And rather than returning home, as it were, it's almost like, hey, you know, why don't you come down here? Like, mm-hmm. It's inviting the Father out of the enclosure rather than waiting to go back in. And that's the interesting thing about the prodigal son. Like, why doesn't the Father go outside and go properly look, you know? And that's what Jesus seems to encourage, is like, look, come on down here and, you know, get with the people. Mm-hmm. So, it's a book that reads that theological turn and reads the prodigal son story against another story from classical literature, which is the Odyssey, which is, you know, turns out to be a really, really similar story, but an idea of homecoming and someone who's away and struggling to get back and all the rest of it turns out very differently.
You almost need a part two to the prodigal son, where the son turns things upside down then once he gets back. And
exactly. And and you know, in terms of any student of literature, I think they would understand that's what should happen, if you see what I mean, because it's a story that doesn't really go anywhere because of that. It's not like the other stories where, you know, the house gets turned upside down to find the coin, or, you know, that someone really goes out and leaves the 99 to find the lost sheep and all the rest of it. It's a much more enclosed beginning and an enclosed end as well, which is kind of fascinating.
Yeah, and it ends with I always thought it was a disturbing ending because it ends with a disgruntled brother. It doesn't actually end happily.
Absolutely. And, you know, my thought in that reading is, well, you know what? You were going to go and do this for both of us, and you failed.
right. It just ends kind of like on a, you know, like a, you know, it doesn't end really happily because
exactly.
It is troubling, really.
Interesting to compare that with the Odyssey, which is a very different kind of story, but it's a story about, you know, someone going on a journey and coming back, and Odysseus, you know, he's struggling to get back, and he's all these troubles and all the rest of it in his life, but in fact his son goes out to find him. His son Telemachus goes out to find his father, and he doesn't find him on some far-flung island, you know, being held captive by anybody. He finds him actually just over the hills on the other side of his home island of Ithaca, and it's like, whoa, what's stopping you from coming home, you know? And actually that thing of being able to be home was the biggest struggle for him. You know, he couldn't make that thing, but his son allowed him, you know, his son, by challenging him, allowed him to make that journey to come home. And I think that actually is why I think we dress our children up as pirates, because we are encouraging them to begin that conversation about when they're going to have to turn against us and have to commit that act of individuation against us as parents. And that's a really healthy thing for them to do. We don't want to subsume their lives into ours. We want them to be free people, people who are, you know, have true liberty, as it were.
Yeah. And that's really painful to let them go, but in a way they have to have to kill us off to have their own lives, in a sense.
They do.
Yeah.
They do. That's why that kind of Darth Vader story is so important. And that's why, you know, it is that really, really powerful moment of death in order to reach that place of liberty. You know, which is why the skull and crossbones, I think, is such a powerful symbol, you know, for kids on their skateboards and all the rest of it. It's not saying I'm fascinated by death. It's saying I am one of the dead. I am part of this community who are dead to oppression, you know. It's an act of liberty to do that, and it's almost like, you know, it's like wearing a cross. It's saying, it's having this kind of connection with ideas of liberation through that being dead to the empire.
And then is it a big switch of gears then for your book, the latest book you've done, and maybe you can tell me what brought you to write the newest book that you've done?
So the latest book I've just released a few weeks ago is called Getting High, A Savage Journey to the Heart of the dream of flight. And so, I mean, first of all, a bit like the pirate book, I didn't mean to write this book. I kind of started writing something else, and it just kind of, I was like, oh, now I realize why I'm writing this. So the book I'd started to write was a book about the infinite. And I was kind of thinking about, you know, writing some stuff to do with mathematics maybe, or, you know, linking that up theologically too. And it the kernel of the idea was me having an argument with Pete Rollins, as I often do, telling Pete that, you know, when he talks about the infinite, he really doesn't know what he's talking about, you know, from a mathematical point of view. And I was like, anyway, so, you know, we had a good old, I mean, Pete's a great friend. We had a great scrap about that, and that was kind of funny. But then as I was writing, I realized that actually what I was really writing about was this kind of very, very ancient human quest for transcendence. Like, we always want to lift away. So I started to explore the history of the human quest for flight, like, you know, not just about the invention of the aeroplane, but this whole quest to leave the ground. Like, where did this all start? And I wanted to try and go back to the roots of this very, very basic urge. Thousands of years ago, what's very clear is that we are probably the strongest animals on this planet. We're pretty fast, we're pretty smart, but there's one thing we can't do. And, we can't fly. And, you know, if you think, like, the world high jump record still stands at something just over 2 meters, it's pathetic. It's like about 1.5 seconds of flight. It's like, that is rubbish. But, you know, there's one thing that we couldn't do, we imbued with huge meaning, like absolute great meaning. This is like, you know, everything about up there becomes about spiritual, about the heavens and so on. And, you know, it's like, you know, the invention of fire, I guess, is such a kind of key thing. But it's there's a 12th century writer called Ibn Tufayl who wrote this book called The Awakening of the Soul, which is a kind of a parable about the birth of human consciousness. And when the guy he's writing about sees fire for the first time, he says, you know, he notices that it always tends to go upwards. And he felt convinced that it's one of the celestial substances, and that it is trying to drive its way back up to join the stars. And it's like this beautiful insight, you know, that fire is straining as these tiny little lights to reach upwards, to rejoin the lights above, you know, in the sun and moon and stars. And we had that same sense within us that we wanted to push closer to the light. So, you know, up there above us becomes the site of perfection. So we talk about the Most High God and the skies are heavenly, and you know, in this emerging Christian theology of celestial beings, you know, the ones who are kind of closest to us as, you know, basically be human are angels, but they've got this one extra feature. Oh yeah, they've got wings.
Right.
You know, they're like us, but they can fly and they burn bright and they're instant messengers and all this kind of stuff. So what's that really interesting then is how that relationship to the vertical progresses. Because actually what happens is that with the development of religion, that flight is seen as a sin. And the kind of very earliest texts talk about, you know, if we want to push up into the heights, that would be sinful, because it would be to proclaim ourselves the same as God.
That's like a prideful...
Exactly. Yeah. But then when flight does finally get invented, and there's all this stuff, like huge arguments going on about whether we should invent flight, you know, because it was, according to the Catholic Church, you know, going to be a sinful thing, all the rest of it. And, you know, physical altitude is still connected to spiritual consequence and all this kind of stuff. But when it does get invented, it is exactly... You know, we hear from these first balloonists exactly these things. They talk about escaping the power of evil. They talk about altitude helping you to find the truth. You know, they talk about the air being light and charming, and that, you know, you're kind of free from all the impurities of the dirty earth below. So we get this idea of the fallen earth below us, and we can lift away to something much more pure. And what I began to take from that is there is one moment in history where all of this really comes together, and that's in the 1960s, where, you know, the technologies of flight just completely get a whole load of new thrusters. And with the LSD counterculture and with Apollo coming at the same time, what you have is the sky being ripped open, both in the kind of inner world and in terms of space. And so the book is really an exploration about what that did to us and what the kind of religious significance is behind those things. Because, you know, I'm absolutely convinced that all technology really is about is religious. All of our technology has some kind of religious purpose. And, you know, that goes right back to the stuff about the Tower of Babel and, you know, all of these tools that we try to generate, and you've got the kind of Icarus myth and all this kind of stuff as well.
You know, that also reminds me of the Pentecostal charismatic movement, really got started around that time too. It's not really drug that I know of, drug infused, but it's still the sort of ecstatic emotionalism of,
you know, the interesting thing is that it is exactly the same people.
This is
the story I tell in the book. Go and read it, because so you've got this character called Lonnie Frisbee, who was total sold out hippie. He's hooking a whole load of acid, and one day in the California hills, he's on a massive LSD trip and reading his Bible, and has this kind of profound meeting with Jesus, and he's like, wow, okay. So he's like, okay, I don't need the LSD. I've now got Jesus. And this is just after the kind of summer of love. So everyone's a bit like, nah, you know, it didn't really work anyway. The LSD didn't kind of bring about the peace that we wanted. So he's like, well, I tell you what could, this kind of new charismatic Christianity. So he starts preaching, and this guy invites him to come and preach in his church, and they throw out all the pews, and they bring in the exact same kind of hippie long choruses music that they're playing on the beaches, and that's what we know as worship tunes. and these two guys start this church together, this LSD hooking hippie and this other guy, and the other guy's name was John Wimber, and the church they started was the Vineyard.
That's right. Yeah, there was a connection.
You know, everything about that charismatic movement, really, the way I read it is, that is basically the counterculture for middle-class Christianity. You know, everyone had their own little counterculture. And for the middle-class Christians, it was charismatic worship. For, you know, white working-class guys, it could have been Hell's Angels, or it could have been something else, you know. But everyone was trying to lift away. And that's what I find fascinating is, okay, you know, we all have our own technologies of flight. And why? And what is it about us that is so desperate to leave the earth behind? And actually the book is far more a kind of personal memoir than anything I've ever written before. And it tells something of my own story as a minister's kid about, you know, going through all of these things and some of the trauma in my own early life about why I was desperate to lift away, how we need to keep our feet on the ground, really.
Oh, wow. Well, what was your particular background in terms of religious upbringing then? Is it Anglican, or was it something?
Yeah, so it was charismatic Anglican. My dad was and still is an ordained minister in the Anglican church. So, you know, we went to church every Sunday, and we were sat there as a family on the front row and paraded. And, you know, and I went the whole way. I hooked the whole tab, I can tell you. You know, I was seriously into every part of it, all of it, absolutely. So, and that goes back generations in my family. So yeah, it was a very full on kind of Christian, charismatic upbringing,
including speaking in tongues and other those types of things. Charismatic or
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that kind of came later, and what kind of is really interesting for me is, you know, in the early 90s, I don't know if you remember the whole kind of Toronto blessing thing.
Oh, yeah. For people who don't know, I was raised as a fundamentalist, so we okay. definitely thought you were going to hell. in my upbringing, that was really clamped down. Let's just say very clamped down. You couldn't put your hands up above your waist, or was probably sinning. You know, since then I'm very far removed from that. But yeah. for people who don't know what you're talking about, and there are plenty of people who listen to this who don't have any, who aren't coming from any faith tradition at all. But
yeah,
maybe you could explain that a little bit.
Well. I mean, kind of oddly, for a God who was meant to be, you know, omnipresent and all the rest of it, it turned out that God was apparently doing things in one particular place in this church in Toronto. Mm. So, you know, a little bit like a drug dealer, I suppose, our pastor went over there to get some of this good stuff and brought it back over, you know. And,
oh, I see what you mean. Yeah.
And so it was spread out, you know, a little piece on each tongue and all the rest of it. Right. And it was pretty much exactly what you might describe, you know, what you might have seen described in the kind of early trips that people like Timothy Leary were taking. I mean, you know, we kept our clothes on, but people were kind of barking like animals and
wow.
roaring with laughter and falling over. And it was hours and hours and hours of this stuff.
Wow.
And what I try and do in the book is to put that into the context of the kind of very long history of inner world transcendental experience mm-hmm. and kind of vision experience, and how, in fact, you know, so many of these things are really, really connected, actually. They're really ancient and very connected, and mm-hmm. and they are really about, you know, they are trips, I suppose, trips, and they are trying to lift us up to that place. And they're kind of, you know, they are technologies, again, that we use to try and lift us away from ourselves. But the interesting thing is that, you know, sociologists would argue now is that the reason why the LSD counterculture took off in such a prolific way was because there was so much anxiety around at the time.
Oh, wow.
I mean,
yeah.
People, you know, they look back on the 60s now and the Summer of Love, but actually it was an incredibly anxious and stressful time.
Oh, right.
You've got the Cold War, you've got nuclear apocalypse, you've got with the emerging Russian space program combined with nuclear weapons, a genuine fear that they could just bomb the hell out of everybody.
Mm-hmm. Plus the proxy wars of Vietnam. And
you've got the wars going on, you've got the civil rights movement coming up, you've got Hell's Angels, you've got alienation in terms of, you know, a new industrialization, all the rest of it.
Yeah.
People are really, really stressed out, and everyone wants to lift away.
Mm.
And people do that across all the social strata in different ways, using different technologies. So some of them using drugs, some of them kind of hooking straight into the space program, and then some of them in much more kind of straight spiritual terms. Interestingly enough, of course, you know, if you look at what's happening in the Apollo missions, they are incredibly evangelistic. They're all about, you know, resisting godless communism and putting Christian, you know, stuff back into space and winning that, you know.
Yeah.
And you know, as soon as these guys are going to space, they're reading out from the Bible, they're taking communion on the moon, all the rest of it.
Right. I think there's a militarism that became evangelicalism later, stemming from originally fundamentalism. Now in the United States anyway, evangelicalism is sort of what old fundamentalism is. It's a little more relaxed now, but essentially evangelicalism is kind of the next thing that came from fundamentalism, where originally my parents kind of met at a fundamentalist seminary. But I see those roots.
I mean,
yeah.
So, you know, and I mean, for me, and then the Toronto thing, going back to that in the 90s, I think what's really fascinating is just how basically stressed I was. I mean, I just left university. I didn't have any clue what I was going to do in terms of a job or all the rest of it. So rather than deal with any of those material difficulties on the ground, I just took a trip right up to the seventh heaven where none of that mattered. You know, I could think about amazing things happening in the spiritual realm, or you know, whatever. And that's the exact same route that you see in the real birth of Pentecostalism in the 20th century, which is in, you know, the very poor communities and oppressed communities of Hispanics and Afro-Caribbeans in LA in the 1920s, the Azusa Street. You know, these are guys who, it's way before the civil rights struggle. They have no rights. They're incredibly oppressed. So without any opportunity to go sideways politically, they go upwards. They just lift away into Pentecostalism. You know, it's that sublime move up to the heavens, which you can do, and it helps you to kind of survive and escape the world.
Yeah. Now, do you see any connection now with a move toward mysticism and some of the there's some of these new sort of native plant movement things going on in the United States of people doing mushrooms and different things like that. And I'm sure it probably happens. Well, there's a huge push for, of course, marijuana and things like that here. But do you sense an analogous thing happening, or is that something else, do you think?
I think it's exactly the same. And, you know, there's no kind of surprise that at the time when, you know, mental health pressures are so acute and rates of depression and kind of, you know, periods of great financial austerity and all the rest of it, that at these times you see, again, these new technologies of lift occurring. And it's not just the drug stuff, you know. I mean, you've got the ayahuasca stuff, you've got all that. But at the same time, you've got, you know, digital technologies are exactly explicitly kind of religious technologies as well. They are there to kind of lift us up to some new purer realm. You know, they are going to perfect us as human beings and give us enormous revelation. So the whole AI movement, I think, is in exactly the same realm, you know. And again, looking back to the 60s, it's the same guys who are kind of jumping from the LSD counterculture into the space program and then on to digital technology at the end of the decade as well.
Yeah, so that's the predicament. Now, does your book have any, like, and here's what we could do? is it more presenting the problem and not so much I mean, not that everything has to have this nice simple answer, but I think you're definitely onto something.
I want the book to be a kind of really practical thing. So it is really a book that is not saying flight is bad. You know, look, that's ridiculous. What it is saying is we need to interrogate carefully all of these different technologies we employ to lift us away, and particularly to try and resist this idea that the earth is somehow fallen. This idea of fallenness on the earth. So it's a celebration of re-grasping a life kind of beyond the transcendent and talking about a material life for now with our feet on the ground. So it's really a plea for us to live with our feet on the ground, because you know what? This is the one earth we've got, and we're going to screw it up if we're not careful. So
I know Peter Rollins also is very into, and I'm not sure how closely you feel with him on this, but he brings his glum Irish ways into it. But I really appreciate that where he talks about that we're okay. It's okay to be sad. It's okay to just embrace the suffering that's going to come our way. That's just part of regular life. That you don't have to fly away from it. You don't have to. That's, you know, obviously very un-American. we're having trouble accepting him for that. But it's the whole point is that our knee-jerk reaction to fly away and get away is that, well, how about sit with it?
Yeah. And you know, interestingly, I think my argument is that the uncritical use of these technologies of flight, whatever they are, actually exacerbate our depression. And that's something I've experienced in my own life. You know, all of this stuff in terms of pursuing the religious and then pursuing other forms of transcendence, I won't go into now, but, you know, we do stuff at college. that, I think, served to make me think that I was outrunning things, but actually I wasn't. And it's actually the way to face this stuff is to say, okay, you know, I'm going to live with my feet on the ground. I think actually, do you know what? I think I'm more hopeful than Pete. And the reason for that is I really honestly do think that for many people, what doesn't help with their depression is their continued insistence on following, you know, a transcendent idea of God. I honestly think that there is a kind of theologized depression going on within Christianity that is unhelpful. And that letting that go can really help people to engage with, you know, life back on the ground. Just as Disney says, let it go, let it go. And in fact, when we're prepared to do that, it's kind of incredibly releasing. There is this extraordinary liberty rather than, you know, the scores of pastors I have, you know, contacting me saying, you know, I'm really down, I'm really depressed, I just don't believe this stuff anymore, what am I going to do? It's like, well, you know, just what's causing the depression is this constant concern that you need to be flying, you know, that you need to be up. Hmm. And once you let that go, things are a heck of a lot easier in many, many ways. Mm-hmm. So it's a really hopeful book, actually. It's a really hopeful book about pushing beyond that and mm-hmm. kind of tells something of a hopeful story in my own situation mm-hmm. too. I mean, you know, some great people have said some really great things about it, and people have been very kind of kind commenting on exactly that in terms of how helpful it's been in all of that. Plus a whole lot of fascinating history about Hell's Angels, drugs and astronauts. I mean, what is not to like?
I know, exactly. I can't wait to get my hands all over it. And yeah, it's fascinating that what you're saying is such a good point, that we keep thinking that to be happy is to kind of be somewhere else. Mm-hmm. And as soon as you give up that idea, a lot of things can fall into place. They're like, oh, actually, yeah, that's an illusion. And I think that can be very satisfying then. You're like, oh, what am I waiting for? Am I waiting for heaven up in the sky? What am I waiting for, to go to a star? What's my problem? Yeah. Just be okay right now.
Yeah, exactly. And I mean, interesting you use the word illusion there, because that's where the final chapter begins with a book that Sigmund Freud wrote called The Future of Illusion, where he talks about the energy that we put into sustaining our illusions. It's extraordinary. Mm. You know, the absolutely huge amount of energy that we throw at sustaining these illusions, and it costs us absolute dear. He says, you know, you have to defend the illusion with all your might. Mm. If the illusion were discredited, then your world would collapse. There'll be nothing left but for you to despair of everything. And he says, you know what? You have to let that illusion go. You have to become disillusioned. because it's only when you become disillusioned that you are able to see beyond what has been illusory. And that's the place of genuine mental health, you know, psychological health and real happiness, is letting that illusion go. Mm. But it's a really tough thing to do. Mm. And he talks about, the person he talks about going through that with is the poet Rainer Maria Rilke, who some of you will know. You know, he's a wonderful poet, but as a young poet, wrote all these love poems to God. But then as the First World War hit, he had a complete mental collapse. Mm. Like, everything beautiful in his world was going. Mm-hmm. And Freud says to him, man, you know, it's going. The illusion is rent. You've got to get with it, you know. Mm. And the energy, you don't have the energy to sustain this illusion. Like, it's too big. So it's this courageous thing about letting the illusion be broken. And that means, you know, coming back down to earth from these flights that we take. Which is a tough thing to do, but it's, man, I can recommend it to everybody. It's the way to feeling healthy, I think. I honestly do.
Yeah, and then you could actually connect with people where they actually are, hopefully in whatever suffering sure. they're going through, instead of something sure. phony you're shooting for that yeah. isn't there.
And rather than lifting away using all our devices and screens the whole time, which is what we're doing, you know, we're lifting away from the present moment.
Yeah.
But to be present is an extraordinary thing to do, a powerful thing to do.
Oh, that is brilliant, Kester. Thank you so much.
Pleasure.
This is a gift. I'm really grateful.
Pleasure. Really great speaking to you.
Oh, so where can people find your work and your website and other ways to get in touch with you?
So I'm on Twitter at Kester Bruin. So that's KesterBruin. You can get the new book, you can get all the books straight from Amazon or through your local bookstore. And I do have a website, kesterbruin.com as well, and on Facebook and stuff. So, yeah, you know, you can order the book straight into the bookstore. It's on Kindle, paperback, hardback, and all the rest. It's right out there. And Mutiny is out there too, a couple of years old now. So
that's good. And do you have anything else that you're cooking up these days?
Yeah. the book has come out just a couple of weeks ago, so I'm kind of slightly in a whirlwind of like, wow, it's like having a new baby. Like,
right. You're not working on anything immediately. You're probably just...
Well, I am.
Are you?
And no, stupidly, yes, I am. I've actually, between writing Mutiny and this book, I was working on a novel which has... got a long way, and I've had lots of encouragement about that. So working with some agents and publishers over here, I want to get that finished now. And it's a novel about teaching. So it's about a high school teacher, and it draws on a lot of these themes too, but in a fictional format. I kind of think, you know, the great thing about fiction is it can be more true because it's not true.
Exactly. So, yes, exactly.
I'm passionate about fiction, even though I teach maths. So that's where I'm going to be trying to head. Plus, I'm also writing and producing a radio program for BBC World Service about the religion of technology and the technology of religion. So that will hopefully be coming out sometime soon.
Yeah, I will link to your website and everything in the show notes, because I was listening to one of your audio bits that you produced in there that I just really loved. It was one of the main things on your website. But...
Yeah, it's called High Flight. So as I was writing the book Getting High, I produced a radio program, which is a kind of 30-minute meditation on flight for the BBC, and that's up there on my website too. And it kind of introduces some of those themes.
It was very moving, and I just adored it. I just adored it. So it will be linked from the show notes here.
Great.
And hopefully I'll try to keep track of you, and would you be willing to come back on?
I would love to do that.
Wonderful. Thank you so much. I appreciate your time. And you'll be coming to the US in a little while?
Hopefully be over end of July. Yeah.
Wonderful. Well, I hope you enjoy your time here, and I hope you can stand us Americans. You'll be noticing a lot of people trying to take flight, I'm sure.
I love you guys. You know that.
Yeah, by then our election cycle will be in a total froth.
So, yeah, exactly.
lucky you.
Well, we might have left the European Union by then. So we're not,
Just head over to Canada. Well, thank you so much. And,
pleasure.
I will... Show notes for this episode can be found at sparkmymuse.com. There you'll find details for websites and people and books mentioned in this episode, and sometimes you'll find photos and videos too. Please stop by and check it out.